Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Check out our website at thetakeaway.org. You'll find other interesting stories, quizzes, and behind-the-scenes photos and videos.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
To state the obvious, it's snowing outside.
Mother Nature is once again reminding us of who is in charge.
Something like a snowstorm, I take very personally. I can see it, I can feel it, I can touch it. It's not an abstraction to me.
You're as cold as ice. You're willing to sacrifice our love, our love, our love.
The sound of snow removal, school closures, and local politics go together on this snowy, blizzardy morning in the Northeast. 22 states have seen the snow prints of this first storm of 2014, which is also a first political test for some office holders who possibly entertain higher aspirations than snow removal. We'll talk to a bobsled pilot thinking about the Olympics, an author thinking about the servant culture in Britain. It's no Downton Abbey, we find out, and the 1964 World's Fair that ended up being more about the past than the future. But first, the present moment in Boston and New York is a snow emergency and a political test for New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo and brand new Mayor Bill de Blasio. The storm is a more severe problem for Boston and outgoing Mayor Thomas Menino, who has just a few days left in office. It's also a very unusual test for Detroit's new mayor, Mike Duggan, who took his oath of office on Wednesday. How do you call out the plows when your city has filed for bankruptcy? Joining me now are reporters from a trio of locations in this nor'easter. Andrea Bernstein, Metro editor for producing partner WNYC. Andrea, welcome.
Hi, John.
Philip Martin, senior investigative reporter for our partner WGBH in Boston. Philip, hello.
Hey, John, investigating snow today.
That's right. And welcome back, Quinn Kleinfelder, senior news editor for WDET in Detroit. Welcome, Quinn.
Hello, John.
So, Philip, the snow totals are the highest there in Boston, but it seems like the political risks are the lowest for the outgoing mayor. What do you say?
Well, yeah, Boston, the first thing you learn in Boston as mayor is politics 101 is snow removal. It's not development, it's snow removal. If you're not on top of that, then you can forget about it in terms of your first term. And Mayor Menino learned that a long time ago. He's called the urban mechanic, because he was on top of snow removal. He figured what Tip O'Neill said many years ago about all politics being local to be absolutely correct, that you have to remove the snow to keep people happy.
And what about the new mayor, the incoming mayor? I mean, Thomas Menino is the longest serving mayor in memory in Boston, and this is really a changing of the guard.
Well, Marty Walsh had his inauguration events wiped out today because of this storm. He's going to be sworn in on Monday, but he's on top of it. He's already sent out a statement to the media and to the citizens of Boston that he's going to be on top of snow removal. The first thing he has to do is to appoint a new snow czar. The snow czar, ironically, but it was planned a long time ago, resigned today. And the first thing that Marty Walsh has to do is to appoint a new snow czar, and he's planning on doing that. He has an interim person in already. And so he's on top of it.
Snow czars. You have to wonder if there's a budget line for a snow czar in the city of Detroit. Quinn Kleinfelder for Mike Duggan. How do you manage an emergency, a snow emergency, even if it's not an actual emergency in Detroit, when you really have to call the financial holders of the city's debt to figure out if you can pay people overtime?
Well, the first thing you do is you don't have the snow czar resign the day you got a really big snow. That's not the greatest way to do it. But in Detroit, this is one thing where bankruptcy is actually focusing things better maybe than causing a problem, because the budget for snow removal is separate from what the other things that would be involved in the bankruptcy process entail. In this case, there's a user, a gas tax, other taxes that specifically go towards the budget for snow removal. And the problem that Mike Duggan faces maybe more than anything is that the budget is kind of, you can imagine it as a balloon. And when you squeeze it, the one end's going to get bigger and the other end's smaller. So they're going to use up a lot of what is still a limited pot of money now to try to get rid of much of the snow that's out here, plus the cold that makes it very difficult to remove some of that. So where the problems really are going to entail is probably near the summer months when they've tried to redo some of the roads, try to fix some of the potholes and things, there's going to be a lot less money available at that time for those repairs.
But at exactly the moment when people are questioning whether Mike Duggan has any power, he can really project that he's an actual mayor in the midst of this bankruptcy, right?
Yeah, in fact, he made a big point of that just a couple of days ago during his official swearing-in ceremony on January 1st. He has no control over the financial decisions in the city because there's an emergency manager. The manager kept control over the police department because it is under a federal consent decree. So Duggan, one of the first things he said was, well, I got up this morning and looked and it was snowy outside. And so I'm off to the snow removal people to go see what they actually deal with to try to understand what it is that causes problems for them. One of the most beloved mayors, I guess, if you want to say that, in recent years in Detroit was Dennis Archer back in the late 90s, early 2000s. He left with a budget surplus, all sorts of good things. But the one hit on his record was that he couldn't remove the snow at that point. They had never really removed snow from Detroit's residential streets, even back then. And people to this day will say the one bad thing they had about Dennis Archer was that he just didn't get that snow out of the way back when. So, yeah, the political ramifications can linger for a long time.
Voters remember things like snow removal. That's Quinn Kleinfelder, senior news editor for WDET in Detroit. Andrea Bernstein, metro editor for WNYC here in the tri-state area. You've got Bill de Blasio, the new mayor of New York, who's sort of the voice of progressive politics in the United States right now. You've got Andrew Cuomo, who has possibly higher aspirations than being governor of New York. And you've got across the Hudson River, Chris Christie, the New Jersey governor. All three are being tested in this storm, yes?
Yes, except that it doesn't seem as of this point that the snowfall amounts are going to be the kind that have tripped up mayors in the past. In the blizzard of 2010, for example, there were feet of snow in New York. Cars and buses in particular were not pulled off the street in the early stages of the blizzard. They were stranded there and the whole thing was a mess. This time around, you've got less snow. Bill de Blasio was out this morning shoveling in front of his house and jeans with his populist touch there. And the systems are a little better than last time. Last time, there was no GPS trackers on the snowplows. Not even the department knew where they were. Now, they have done this, and they've done this in Boston. They've put GPS on the plows, and there are maps on the internet where not only the dispatchers and the city emergency command can watch them, but so can individuals. So that was a big problem. So a lot of that's been corrected, fortunately for Bill de Blasio. Now, Andrew Cuomo loves an emergency. And for him, going into emergency mode, going around, talking to the people of the state, mobilizing the state troopers, this is the time where he loves the most to come out in public. He doesn't really chat the way, say, Governor Christie does with the press much, but he will when the chips look down Mother Nature-wise.
So it's really an opportunity for these two New York politicians. And Chris Christie, of course, is, governor of New Jersey, has been very much seen in times of emergency, his profile raised during Sandy. In the case of these three politicians, this storm is really an advantage at this point.
Well, I think for Bill de Blasio, I mean, he's fortunate that this is not a severe test. It's a test for a mayor who was elected to change progressive policies. But he put in place a lot of government veterans. This was something that he said. You need people with government experience to make change. These are people with a long history. So he does have a team who know how to handle things like snow emergencies. He did this deliberately so that that kind of thing could be taken care of and he could focus on the agenda that he wants to.
All right. Well, I should say that my two 15-year-old daughters, thinking about whether school was going to be canceled today, insisted that if Bill de Blasio did not cancel school today, they wouldn't be voting for him when he's up for re-election. They will be eligible voters in 4 years. Andrea Bernstein and Philip Martin and Quinn Kleinfelder, one last question. What do you think politically 2014 is going to be about for the politicians that we've been speaking of? Andrea, you begin.
Well, I think for Bill de Blasio, the entire progressive community in the country is looking to him. They were disappointed with Barack Obama, with the American Care Act. So Bill de Blasio is the guy who has to carry their banner, and he has to do it right. So no mistakes. I think that it looks like he's probably exhaling right about now. I did want to add there was a huge Lobby Dante campaign yesterday. Dante, of course, is Bill de Blasio's famous son that helped him get elected. I think every high schooler in New York was Facebooking him, asking him to get his dad to institute a snow day.
Philip Martin, what is politics in Boston going to be like in 2014?
A little more subtle than New York, but income inequality is going to be on the agenda here. And I think that Andrea's right. The mayor here, Mayor-elect Walsh, is looking at this issue in the context of rent, in the context that the city is becoming less affordable for many people. So look for that to be on the agenda. And by the way, snow removal, he has little else on his agenda so far. He hasn't appointed many people at all, but he has appointed an interim snow remover, and he has attended drills to remove snow. So that, too, is going to be an important issue. But income inequality will trump just about anything, and it will take place in the context of rents. The rents are too high, according to many people here in Boston.
Last words from Quinn Kleinfelder, senior news editor at WDET in Detroit. Quinn?
Not to put too fine a point on it, but when will democracy return to the city of Detroit? It's under the control of a state-appointed emergency manager right now that makes all the really significant decisions. They're going to announce soon their plan to emerge from bankruptcy. In the meantime, the elected officials in the city really have little power. And so in September, they can technically vote out the emergency manager. The mayor and the city council can do that if the state doesn't change the laws. They can, and they can extend the financial crises. There's been some talk they could make Mayor Duggan at that point become the emergency manager. You really don't know. But at this point, the people that were elected to run the city of Detroit are not running it. It's being run by the state and the emergency manager. And until at least September, and it begins to emerge from bankruptcy, that situation is unlikely to change.
Political winds and winter winds blowing in Detroit and Boston and in the tri-state area in New York and New Jersey. Quinn Kleinfelder, senior news editor for WDET. Philip Martin, senior investigative reporter for our partner WGBH. Andrea Bernstein, metro editor for our producing partner WNYC. Thanks to all of you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
So I gather there's two big categories of you out there. There are those of you in the storm's path, 22 states. That's a lot of folks. And then there are those of you who go, Northeasterners need to look at the calendar. It is January. And what happens in January? It snows. Here's some early voter sentiment of folks in the storm's path. Ryan writes on Facebook, I live across the street from a Dunkin' Donuts that wouldn't close for Armageddon. I'm good. Leslie says, put gas in the car. I made a pot of chicken soup. We're headed over there, Leslie. Nancy, got food for the cats and wine for me. Give a little wine to the cats, all right? And Jane, filled my gas tank, then parked at bottom of steep driveway, restocked peanuts for squirrels yesterday. Squirrels benefiting from this storm. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and if you're getting stuck indoors this weekend, you can check out WNYC's helpful Snowpocalypse Boredom Survival Guide. Why anyone would need a boredom survival guide in the city of New York? But hey, we love what WNYC does for all of us. It includes recipes, activities, songs, and suggestions for you and yours to make the most of the storm. And you can call to share your own suggestions. Any sort of public radio audio or video clips of you sitting around singing songs during the storm, we'd love to air them on the program next week. That's at WNYC.org. Hey, I've got the wrong attitude here. I need to adjust it. We want to remind you, you can get involved in the takeaway every day, of course. Get an early jump on our conversations. Be a part of our listener response network. You just text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Coming up, whoa.
We do hit up to 6G forces, and that's what fighter pilots face. I hit up to 90 miles per hour in less than a minute.
A calm talk about a wild ride. Jasmine Fenlater, a pilot of the U.S. Olympic women's bobsled team, talking about the road to Sochi. Stay with us. You know, we could probably hold the 2014 Winter Olympics right here in blizzardy New York City or the Northeast this weekend. It's hovering around 0 Fahrenheit in many places, but it's 52 and sunny today in Sochi, Russia, the real side of the Games, where they're predicting rain but no snow over the next 10 days. Whatever the weather, Jasmine Fenlater will be in Sochi representing the U.S. as a pilot on the U.S. Olympic women's bobsled team. She is trained in track and field with serious upper body strength from holding college records in shot put and discus. At the Winter Games, though, she gets to use that strength to make for a wild ride down the mountain.
A lot of people think it can be a roller coaster ride. It's far from. We do hit up to 6G forces, and that's what fighter pilots face. I hit up to 90 miles per hour in less than a minute and have to navigate down an icy chute of bends and winds at basically a controlled car crash.
you know, as a track star and as an Olympian, you rely on equipment to do your work, the shot, the hammer, the sled. Do you get kind of emotionally connected to individual pieces of equipment? Do they get names? Do they have a kind of a nickname sort of backstory?
Definitely. On Team USA women's bobsled team, we have a tradition where a sled that's used in Olympic Games, if it wins a medal, whatever pilot named that sled, the name remains. So I was very fortunate and honored to drive for 2 years the bronze medal sled from Vancouver, and its name was Pinky, from the pilot Aaron Pack. So those things kind of stay along the line. I'm looking to name my sled this year. With Sochi in mind, I'd like to have it be a Russian name and represent not just me, but the people who supported me and my team and the mission and the journey that I've taken along this road to Sochi.
And what is that journey for you as an athlete and as someone who, you know, has made their way to captain?
I think Jasmine Fenlater's journey has been filled with tragedy, loss, resilience, perseverance, hope, and determination. And I think for anyone around the United States and around the world, that is what your life is about, that life's journey. And if you have a goal and want to succeed, it's going to be filled with ups and downs throughout the way, and sacrifices and hard times, bad times, as well as those victorious times. And at the end of the day, you can combine all of them and look at the big picture and hopefully see a lot of light in that.
Is there a scene? Is there a moment? Is there a loss that you picture in your mind when you're facing a really serious challenge at a competition like the Olympics that gives you strength?
I think when I think of the experience that I hope to have going into the Olympics, I don't necessarily think of sadness or a loss. What I think of is the struggle that's made me who I am. And that comes a lot from my mom and what she goes through on a daily basis. She's extremely ill. We lost our home in Hurricane Irene, and we've had a lot of deaths throughout the family due to illnesses and things like that. And over time, as an Olympic hopeful, you travel and make those sacrifices and financial struggles to hopefully be at the Olympic Games. And when I walk into opening ceremonies, I think that brief moment of having Team USA on my back and knowing my mom is either there or at home cheering me on is going to be the moment that I look back and say, oh, man, we did it.
You know, we're really now seeing in the Olympics full participation for the world. What does that mean for you as an African American, and what does that mean for the sports?
I'm super excited to be, I guess you would say, part of that movement and light to bring culture to the Winter Olympics. I think there's always been a stigma for some winter sports. They're either too expensive for certain types of people or cultures to get involved in, or you live in a warm weather country, so there's no way you can do a winter sport. And seeing that participation around the world, Panama has a bobsled team. Brazil has a bobsled team. The Jamaican Cool Runnings 2 is coming back.
Yeah, so they really were the pioneers in Jamaica.
For sure. So I think it's super exciting to have that involvement. The Olympic movement and spirit is about 2 weeks of unity and every nation bringing forth their best, but being united as a world front at the same time and having respect for each other, regardless of cultural differences.
How concerned are you about the controversy in Russia, the political issues that are certainly in play and have offended and outraged many gay and lesbian athletes in the United States and around the world?
I think Russia is really trying to host a great Olympic Games. And to be honest, regardless of their political perception or output or rules that they want to make, the Olympic movement is way stronger than that. And I'm going forward for that Olympic dream. And for 2 weeks, I know that the nations will unite and have an understanding and respect for each other. And hopefully that will be a statement that leads the way going after the games and will resolve whatever issues and disappointments people have.
Spoken like a diplomat, President Obama, you may recall, mentioned in his comments on the controversy in Russia, hey, they're creating a disadvantage by not including everyone on their teams. Do you go along with that?
Definitely. I think that I want to beat someone who's the best. I don't want to beat people because people were left out. It's a privilege to represent your nation, and it's an honor. And if you've earned that right, you should be there to compete.
So your mom's backing you. Your family's backing you. Certainly your sense of your own personal history is helping to push that sled. But to make this work, you've got to have sponsorship. You've got to, you know, you got to raise money like a congressional candidate, right?
Yes.
How difficult is that?
It's extremely difficult. Leading up to this year, I've worked up to 4 jobs in the off season, freelancing, babysitting, working at small businesses, large businesses, in order to not just finance my Olympic dream, but finance my regular bills that I have, student loans, cell phones, et cetera, to live. People often don't realize that Olympic hopefuls and Team USA were not funded to have a salary. The USOC is completely nonprofit and relies on large companies and private donors to help support Team USA. And fortunately, Liberty Mutual Insurance is a huge part of that this year and leading the road to Sochi. And I've been named a member of 13 full athletes that are on their campaign for rising and coming back. And they're a company that support people who have gone through hard times and back them during that. And I'm glad to represent people like that.
And Liberty Mutual probably wouldn't want, as part of its brand, encouraging people to go at 6 G's around a turn, right?
They encourage me.
Jasmine, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Jasmine Fenlater is a pilot of the U.S. Olympic women's bobsled team. She'll be competing in Sochi next month at the Winter Games. This is The Takeaway. I'm out walking around, hands in my pocket. I'm out in the cold, body and soul. As sectarian battles rage in Syria and Lebanon, a new offensive seems to be opening in Iraq between Sunni and Shiite militants. Fighting under the banner of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, Sunni militants have captured territory and are flexing their muscle in majority Shiite Iraq. Joining us now, Tim Arango, Baghdad Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. Welcome.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Tim, can you give us a sense of the scale of the violence over the past several weeks?
Yeah, I mean, Iraq has been on a steady decline over the last 2 years since the American troops left, but things have gotten steadily worse, especially as Syria has heated up. And over the last week, actually, it's been pretty dramatic in Anbar province, with militants actually seizing control of large amounts of territory within those two important cities.
Now, to an Iraqi civilian, an average Iraqi, if there is such a thing, what would you say is the message delivered by these victories or apparent military territorial victories by Sunni militants?
Well, it probably depends on if you're Sunni or Shia. The country is still so fractured along those lines. But still, I think the ordinary Sunni just wants to live in peace and does not want to live under these militants. But the problem is the Shiite government's strategy to deal with the violence is only focused on security, which often alienates ordinary Sunnis and increases the amount of sympathy among the Sunni community for the militants.
So there's a certain amount of sympathy and a general sense of hopelessness that the best you can do is simply stay out of the way, which really invites more violence, I suspect.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for instance, the government strategy on all this for a long time has been to simply launch these massive security operations in Sunni communities. And what they do is they end up arresting large numbers of people, militants and many ordinary civilians alike. And so what they do is often alienate the broader Sunni community, which they depend on for information and intelligence. And they're just not getting that because no one's inclined to cooperate with the Shiite government in the Sunni communities.
You know, since the so-called Arab Spring, some folks, perhaps irresponsibly, have suggested that beneath the movement of unrest and so-called democratic empowerment in the Arab world is this momentum to actually have an all-out battle between Sunni and Shiite. Does that seem like a less irresponsible claim today?
I don't think that was the intent of, you know, democratic-minded people who started these uprisings around the Arab world. But what I think's happened is, you know, the radicals, the extremists, have seized on the turmoil, and it's perfect, fertile ground for them to make gains.
The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, is there any sort of credibility to that whatsoever in the sense of drawing a line of violence straight through from Lebanon all the way through to Iraq?
I think that worry is real. I think if you look at the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, it was sort of fostered by Iraq. I mean, when the first extremist Sunni group started fighting in Syria, they were basically fostered by what had been left of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And now it's almost like a revolving door between the two countries.
And there's no U.S. role at this point, no security infrastructure that could have any meaningful impact here at this point.
Well, the Americans have never stopped giving Iraq security support. Even after the troops left 2 years ago, there's a really large-scale weapons sales program to the Iraqis that moves slower than the Iraqis would like. And just recently, in recent months, Maliki went to Washington and asked for more practical weapons because the Americans had been selling them things like F-16s, which aren't going to be operational for a long time and probably don't help much for street fighting in Fallujah. So just recently, the Americans just rushed, I think, 75 Hellfire missiles to the Iraqis and also surveillance drones to help them. And apparently CIA is on the ground helping them with targeting, because what we see now is a lot of militant camps in the deserts of Anbar and in places in Diyala province.
Reporting on the surge of violence in Iraq, Tim Arango is Baghdad bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So some folks are going to get some free time on this Friday if the storm kept you away from the office or school. Movie Time Friday with Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, and Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. They together are the Movie Day podcast. We decided we'd do something a little different this Friday. Welcome.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
So with our free time, we have the opportunity to actually see some films that are still in theaters that maybe, you know, we missed for one reason or another because the holidays are such a busy time. And, you know, what would you put on your list to get people ready for the awards season, which is quick upon us, movies that people could go see so they have a broader sense of what's actually up for consideration? Rafer?
I think my first choice would be Blue Jasmine, which you can still find in theaters. It's the Woody Allen film with Cate Blanchett as a woman, sort of a Ruth Madoff figure. She's, I think, going to be up for an Academy Award for sure, and I think she's got a very good shot at winning it.
You absolutely love this, I remember.
I loved this movie. I just thought it was a great tragicomedy, and Cate Blanchett is just fantastic in it.
And I remember Kristen hated it, but let's listen.
With wealth comes responsibilities. I wasn't just some mindless consumer like so many of my so-called friends. Though I won't say I dislike buying pretty clothes. Tip big, boys. Tip big because you get good service, and they count on tips. You know, someday, when you come into great wealth, you must remember to be generous.
Fallen Women and Money, that's a formula for Woody Allen. What else is on your list, Rafer?
I would also say Inside Llewyn Davis, the Coen Brothers film with Oscar Isaac as a struggling folk singer in the 1960s in Greenwich Village. I love this movie. I don't feel like it's been the next Oh Brother, Where Art Thou that everyone's been running to see, but I think it's really good, really great portrait of New York in the 60s. I think another movie that Kristen disliked, but one of my favorites.
And you also love the Spike Jones. Let's remind people of her.
How do you share your life with somebody?
Well, we grew up together. I used to read all of her writing all through her master's and PhD. And she read every word I ever wrote. And we were a big influence on each other. I still find myself having conversations with her in my mind.
So a movie starring Scarlett Johansson, but you don't get to see her. That's Joaquin Phoenix there in Her, a man falls in love with a computer software. Basically, Siri.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, people jokingly call this the Siri movie. It's the voice of Scarlett Johansson as an operating system. I loved this film. I have not been able to stop thinking about it since I saw it probably a couple months ago now. I think it's so fascinating. I think it's a whole new kind of science fiction movie. I loved it. I think it could be a dark horse contender at the Oscars as well.
All right, and just to, in full disclosure, Kristen hated the premise, hated the movie. What's on your list, Kristen?
I have better movies on my list. First of all, I have Philomena, starring Judy Dench and Steve Coogan.
Talked about this at all.
No, we haven't. And I have to say, this movie is just a small, lovely, beautiful movie that's not getting a lot of buzz, and it should.
How do you feel about that, going to America with Martin?
I don't know.
I could come with you if you like.
No, you have your work. I'm only worried that Martian may have to go a lot away with a daft old woman like me.
I don't think you're daft.
I'll go away with you.
Or old.
I think I would like to go. I'd like to know if Anthony ever thought of me. I've thought of him every day.
You know, I'd watch Judi Dench read traffic signs.
Oh, she's fantastic in this. This is the story of a woman whose child was essentially taken from her and placed for adoption, sold to Americans. She goes in search of the son.
All right.
On
you
what
love.
Would be his 50th birthday. It's a great movie.
Philomena, number two for
Dallas,
you.
Dallas Buyers Club, absolutely. Matthew McConaughey and Jared Leto in this movie, bringing AIDS drugs into the U.S. in the 1980s when they're hard to come by. It's fantastic.
And finally, let's start a fight.
The ice, Jace. She moves like a woman. I'm Walter. Mitty.
Cheryl. Melhoff. Where have you been?
Testing the limits of the human spirit.
I'd like to climb your hair, test that out.
A radical restatement of The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. Good idea?
Absolutely. Takes it to the next level.
Disastrous. I can't stand this film.
Things to do with your free time this weekend with Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer of the Movie Date podcast. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Take some Swiss Twists.
Oh, to wash endless dishes, make beds, and worry about money and lost fortunes. For millions of American public TV watchers, this idea of Sunday night rest and relaxation is called Downton Abbey. Season 4 begins this weekend.
What is a weekend?
That's the better half of Downton, Lady Violet, played by Maggie Smith, and the downstairs servants, who certainly know what a weekend is, form a parallel universe in this drama.
In the old days, their mothers used to train them, at least in the basics. Now they arrive knowing nothing.
Perhaps their mothers don't want them in service anymore.
What are they supposed to do? Become bankers and lawyers?
And why not, Mr. Carson? Why not?
But the servants of Downton Abbey represent the pinnacle of a culture of service, pride, and subservience that is centuries old in Britain. Lucy Lethbridge is the author of Servants, a downstairs history of Britain from 19th century to modern times. The servant-nobility relationship, she says, shaped nearly everything in British life, from the style of buildings to literally the kitchen sink.
If you look at households of the 18th and 17th century, although there were clearly people doing very menial work in the house and doubtless being treated very badly as well, people tended to sleep on the same floor, they tended to share the same space much more. And in the 1830s, when Victoria comes to the throne, there is a change of attitude. The family suddenly becomes sacrosanct, partly due to the rise of evangelical Christianity, partly due to a new sort of middle-classness of ordinary English life. And when the family is sacrosanct, then outsiders must be separated. So you get this stress that is reflected in architecture, of which suddenly becomes imbued with backstairs and basements and corridors, in which you get two communities really living under the same roof, very clearly demarcated. The maid looks like a maid, the mistress looks like a mistress. And this becomes increasingly important as a sign of status in a world, I think, increasingly fearful of the politicization of the working class.
You know, in movies like Gosford Park and to a certain extent in Downton Abbey, the depiction is of a parallel universe, that there's almost the exact same hierarchy downstairs as there is upstairs. It's just that the twain shall rarely, if ever, mix.
Yes, those hierarchies are reflected, and hierarchies were seen to be very important, not only as a social order, but as a form of management. And indeed, you could say it worked quite well as management, because certainly the ladder of preferment in the servants' hall was very clearly marked. And the butler was very likely to have started off as a hall boy, cleaning shoes and sleeping in the hall, and have inched his way up the ladder to become the butler, which was, in the world of the servants' hall, regarded as a very high professional standing.
These butlers are so powerful in popular culture. Batman has a butler. One of the biggest startups in the dot-com era was an information site called Ask Jeeves that had a butler as the icon. You know, they go beyond time and class.
Well, I think that the idea of the clever manservant, which is the Jeeves, isn't it, where the manservant is cleverer and wiser than his master. I mean, that's a very old trope. It goes right back to Shakespeare and further back than that. But then you read butlers' memoirs and you realise that actually many of them were very, very like that. And they develop this rather sort of ponderous language about perfection and duty. And of course, they tended to be conservative. They tended to believe themselves to be the sort of paterfamilias of the servants' hall, the mirror image of their employer upstairs. I think in Downton Abbey, the figure of Carson is very accurately drawn in that way. He is a very recognisable and, as a result, very poignant character.
Where did the servants traditionally come from?
Traditionally, servants in a country house like Downton or Gosford would have come primarily from the village and the estate. I mean, one can't stress enough the enormous web of dependency that those large estates had. So while there was land and tied cottages and villages and things, that the shadow of the big house fell very far. And indeed, you were lucky to get work in a big house because it was far preferable to work in a large house like Downton than it would be to work in a cash-strapped urban home because you'd probably eat better than you had ever eaten at home, and you would have the chance to meet people. And this was very important. One of the things about middle-class homes that is particularly poignant is that the servants often said they never met anyone. And so, of course, their chances for marriage were diminished, and marriage was the only escape. But advertising, what was called the sits vac, the situations vacant in local newspapers or in the Morning Post, which was a now-defunct paper, had a lot of columns devoted to people advertising for servants or servants advertising for work. Or the Times. If you look at any copy of the Times before the war, you will see maybe an entire page of columns of advertisements for domestic positions.
At what point, and this is an architectural detail that I found fascinating, at what point did the kitchen in British middle and upper class homes move from the basement upstairs?
The decline of servants changed the whole shape of the ordinary house. So an urban house, which had been, say, built in 1850, to take a sort of typical London terrace house, would have had the servants' quarters would have been completely separate, like a little warren of rooms with a back stairs and a basement steps and a back entrance. And that all changes. It changes because, of course, if you no longer employ a cook, if you're doing your own cooking, then cooking is, A, raised in status, but also you need to be somewhere in the centre of the house because it's very likely you're also got to keep an eye on your own children. So gradually the shape of the home alters and the kitchen comes upstairs. It becomes bigger because once you've got to do your own cooking, you realise how inconvenient it is to cook in some tiny, cramped little corridor with a blazing grate and virtually no light. So it's pulled up, it's made larger, it's made more convenient, and it then becomes customary, even fashionable, to eat in the kitchen. This was something we imported from the States, I think, this idea of the kitchen diner, which was considered in the 1950s a very sort of daring and risque.
Daring and risque to eat in the kitchen. Lucy Lethbridge is the author of Servants, A Downstairs History of Britain from the 19th Century to Modern Times. Lucy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
As bundled-up New Yorkers scrape the gritty, snow-clogged streets of an all-too-real winter urban landscape here in New York City, let's take you into a dream New York of a half century ago.
People hardly know where to begin when they step into the world of the fair. It has something of everything, something for everyone. The international area is crowded with exhibits from many nations. The industrial area has its lure in the miracles of science and technology. Across the Bridge of Nations is the transportation area with Ford Motor Company's pavilion.
The New York World's Fair of 1964-65 claimed to be all about the future, a bright, positive future for the world.
We invite visitors from every state and land, solicit their friendship, and devoutly hope that in presenting here this Olympics of progress, we shall draw them closer together in our shrinking globe and thus, in the end, promote peace.
But the fair, if anything, was the closing of a chapter, a signal of the decline and ultimate political end for Robert Moses, speaking there, who had shaped the city in his image for much of the 20th century, and that city was in a turmoil. no shiny World's Fair could conceal.
We have had some troubles in New York City in recent days, and there has been sensationalized reports of crime in our city. It is a fact that some people, hearing that these reports of riots, have canceled many hotel reservations and plans to visit New York. And yet it is also a fact that to this date, there is a perfect record, as far as the Commissioner of Police knows. No single visitor to our city has been physically attacked or brutalized in any way.
New York Mayor Robert Wagner trying to downplay Harlem's 1964 riots, a hint of things to come. Joseph Torella is author of Tomorrowland, the 1964-65 World's Fair and the Transformation of America. He says the World's Fair represented both a future fantasy and a jaded symbol of the hard realities New York and America were about to experience.
It was a seminal event in the lives of millions of people. 51 million people went, especially for New Yorkers and people in the Northeast. I mean, everyone of a certain age knew about the fair and went to the fair. And for them, it marks their childhood in much the same way that if you were alive at the time, the Kennedy assassination, civil rights. It's a major event of the 60s. And for that generation, it was an opportunity to see what the future might look like, what the wider world looked like.
It was also an encounter with some extraordinary egos. I remember the Life magazine cover with Robert Moses on the cover, looking at the scale model of the fair, and my father making some sort of disparaging remark about how this is Moses's fair. And in some ways, it was his fair, but events also overtook even his own conception of the fair.
Completely. And your father was 1,000% right. Moses really thought of it as his fair, and everyone else did. And his idea about it, you know, the peace through understanding, which was the theme of the fair, he inherited that, but he embraced it. He tried everything he could to kind of keep the times of what was happening outside of the fair gates outside the fair. But that was next to impossible. I mean, fairs by nature are political, even more so than the Olympics, because the president of the United States opened the fair. And when Lyndon Johnson came, and it's 5 months to the day that John Kennedy is assassinated, there's large, wild civil rights protests at the fair, because at the time, this is what was happening in America. And you couldn't shut it out, and Moses tried. So he was overtaken by the events of the time. So then to have this massive fair, which spent millions and millions of dollars, a huge public works program.
Lost money.
And that's kind of why he became a target. The whole plan was he wanted to remake Flushing Meadow Park, and he'd been wanting to do that since the 20s. And he thought the fair was his opportunity, and that never really happened.
And so the leftovers from the World's Fair in 64 have become the alien portal in Men in Black, right?
That's right.
The Unisphere is still there and in good condition.
Yeah.
But the steel companies that manufactured it probably aren't.
He actually wanted Walt Disney to create a kind of mini theme park. And then when the fair was over, it would continue. But New York City wasn't going to fund it.
You know, Disney, as a kind of a prophet of pop culture in America, had a role in the fair. Yes. Andy Warhol, yes, as another kind of prophet of pop culture, had a role in the fair. And the music at the time, Bob Dylan and other pop musicians coming up in this, you know, I guess you can't really call rock and roll in 1964 an underground movement, but still it was controversial enough that that interaction was a rich brew.
Well, that was another thing that completely overtook Moses, was the whole Beatlemania. I mean, you have to think, Beatlemania is literally running wild. But in Moses, he couldn't bridge that gap. He was 75 years old when the fair opened. The Beatles was not his thing. He was into classical music. He was really into easy listening. He loved Guy Lombardo and the Royal Canadians, nothing against them, but that was a house band at the World's Fair, and that was because Moses wanted it. And, you know, Tom McCann, the shoe company, wanted to sponsor the dance floor outside this band shell. And someone in the marketing team writes to Moses and says, you know, I don't think that Guy Lombardo, though they're very, you know, he's really good, I don't know that's really what's right in 1964 for the audience that we're looking for our customers and for your customers. And Moses just wouldn't have anything of it and basically just dismissed the guy. And then he's like, no, Guy Lombardo, he's very popular, even with some kids.
Boy, if it was done today, the shoe company would run the whole show.
It's true.
The book is called Tomorrowland, the 1964-65 World's Fair and the Transformation of America. And right on the front cover, you know, there's a picture of Dylan and Warhol and a very nice sort of stately picture of the fair with the Unisphere. But also Malcolm X.
Yes. So Malcolm X actually lived in Queens. But the reason he got in the book is he gives his famous Ballad of the Bullet speech. And for me, that speech just kind of summarized what was happening. You know, talk about predictions for the future. He predicted the race riots that would polarize the country over the next several years. And the very first summer of the fair, of course, was the Harlem riots of 1964, where a teenager on the Upper East Side was shot dead by a police officer under very dubious circumstances. And it touched off a tremendous riot. And about halfway through the first fair session, Moses was getting letters like, is it safe to come to New York? So he was very concerned because everything that was happening in New York and then the Harlem riots, people were staying away. I mean, I saw letters where people said, we were going to come, we had tickets, but we're going to do something a little safer. And that was a real concern. And this is really how the way he couldn't keep the events of the country out of the fair.
But, of course, Moses is coming out of the golden age of New York where everything's kind of Fifth Avenue and motorways and all of the sort of safety and kind of utopia, and entering a period of decline where Central Park was the equivalent of getting mugged after dark. You'd never That's go right. there. And today, New York is, in a sense, closer to that Moses vision. You got Times Square looking like a Disney park. You've got everybody coming here, you know, to eat Red Lobster. What would Moses think of the kind of theme park New York of today?
I mean, Moses' shadow over New York is as large as the Manhattan skyline. There's no way to walk around the city and look at anything and not eventually find your way to him. I think he would be just fine with what New York is becoming. I'm sure he would probably have many opinions about how he could improve it.
And he wouldn't have gotten the joke of Men in Black.
No, I don't think he would. I don't think he would have seen that movie.
Joseph Torello is the author of Tomorrowland, the 1964-65 World's Fair and the Transformation of America. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You work and work for years and years. You're always on the go.
Guy Lombardo, The Beatles, Guy Lombardo, Jay-Z, Mr. Future, thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a safe weekend, brave in the storm. This is The Takeaway.
You'll have your fun when you're a millionaire. Imagine all the fun you'll have in your old rocking chair.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.